I'm reading from Uncommon Wisdom, Life and Teachings of Ajahn Panyawaro. I'm starting on page 163 in the chapter on rebirth. When we understand that everything we experience in the present results from past causes, we begin to reorder our priorities. It is obviously not possible to change the past. Consequently, the way we respond to what happens to us now becomes the important matter, because present actions will shape our future. We begin to take responsibility for our situation once we realize that what we experience in this lifetime results from causes we ourselves created in the past. Instead of feeling like helpless victims of an unfair system, we break the habit of blaming others for everything that goes wrong in our lives. In other words, we take full control of our life and our destiny. The Buddha said that we should use wisdom in everything we do. That means looking at and examining the intentions behind our behavior. Are our actions based on defilements or on Dharma? We should be very careful of the actions we do in every day to make sure that we do not perform bad actions that will cause us suffering in the future. Before initiating any course of action, we must make sure that it is leading in the right direction. We should look to see what we are involving ourselves in, what we are involving other people in, and how that will affect us down the road. Because in the end, everything we do is creating karma. We should take care not to unnecessarily build up a store of unwanted results. So we have to be wise and careful in the choices we make. The important thing is how we respond to situations as they arise. By reacting skillfully, we can change our response from negative to positive. Choice is the positive side of karma. As human beings, we can make choices based on our innate intelligence. This is one of the reasons why a human birth is so valuable. Animals are basically creatures of instinct, making it difficult for them to have much choice. They lack the means to develop a broader view of their situation. People, on the other hand, have a choice. They don't have to follow their basic instincts and react negatively when confronted with the inevitable unpleasantness of life. It's worth contemplating death from time to time. The interesting thing about death is that after death, nothing of what you can call yourself is left. The body breaks up and disintegrates. No essence remains there. Feelings, thoughts, and memories break up as well. All that's left is your karma. After all, what is death? Firstly, it's the breakup of one's body. If one views the body as an integral part of one's self-identity, it's the breakup of oneself. Then one's karma fashions an environment based on one's past actions, which is grasped as a ground for rebirth. But the one that is born is not the same one that died. They're on the same continuum, but they are not the same person. Then again, we can't say that they're different either, because they both share the same karmic legacy. When you reach the time of death, what's going to happen? Try to visualize it. Think of the body. What happens when the body dies? When the body dies, all sensation goes with it. Sight, sound, smell, taste, and touch all vanish. So your normal perception of the world disappears. Your possessions all go completely. You won't have control over the slightest part of them. You are totally on your own. You should consider that and think about what it means. Why do you place so much importance on your possessions? Why are you so concerned about what other people think of you? Why are you so concerned about your social status or your position at work? If you are well aware of death, if you contemplate death a lot until you feel it and see it clearly, the importance of these things tends to drop away. Because of that, when they eventually change or disappear, you are no longer affected. The only possession you keep at death is your karma. And the best way to make sure that it is good karma is to do Buddhist practice. This is right karma, because it is the direct training for the sake of nibbana. The karma of doing the practice is the best kind you can make. Page 120. Aside from his chronically swollen foot and a host of lingering aches and ailments, Ajahn Panya's health remained predictably stable over the years. The hot and humid seasons took their toll on his physical vitality, but minor operations on his foot, appendix, and prostate did little to slow him down in old age. He appeared to be aging gracefully with unflagging vigor. Then, at the age of 77, in the monsoon days of September 2003, a routine blood test uncovered telltale traces of internal bleeding. A slow and almost imperceptible loss of blood was occurring somewhere within his body. By analyzing the blood count, the doctors measured the loss, but they could not pinpoint its location. Follow-up tests pointed to the colon as the most likely culprit. When a colonoscopy exam discovered a malignant growth at the upper end of Ajahn Panya's large intestine, the doctors insisted on operating immediately to remove the tumor. Ajahn Panya was not noticeably sick. In fact, he felt and appeared quite buoyant. If the doctors had not detected it through a blood test, he would not have suspected a problem. After a period of calm reflection, Ajahn Panya gratefully dismissed their offer of surgery, saying he preferred instead to treat the malignancy with traditional herbal medicines. A disciple of his at the monastery quickly arranged for the delivery of a potent Thai herbal remedy, which Ajahn Panya began ingesting immediately. Appearing unfazed by the urgency surrounding his condition, he carried on with his daily routine as if nothing out of the ordinary had happened. Convinced that the medicine was working, he travelled to Bangkok several months later to get a full checkup. An MRI scan found that the tumour had shrunk from its original length of 5 centimetres down to only 1 centimetre. The news was welcome and most encouraging. Ajahn Panya took the herbal concoction scrupulously for an additional 5 months. In early May 2004, he was admitted to the hospital for another colonoscopy. The results confirmed what he suspected, that the tumour had disappeared. No graphic evidence that could be found. The upper colon appeared blessedly free of cancer. He seemed to be out of the woods. The question then arose, should he continue with the herbal medication now that the treatment had proved successful? A specialist in traditional Thai medicine advised him against halting the therapy abruptly. Instead, he was advised to carry on with it, but at half the dosage. His attendant monks pleaded with him to play it safe and heed the doctor's advice. Ajahn Panya concluded otherwise. Contrary to the broad consensus of his supporters, he decided to discontinue the herbal remedy, reasoning that it had done its job and was no longer needed. It turned out to be a fateful decision. Within 6 weeks, Ajahn Panya's health seriously degenerated. His students could see that his formal vitality and alertness were waning. As time passed, the decline became more pronounced. By mid-July, he experienced an ongoing and severe intestinal disorder. It became clear that he was having a relapse, and that this time he would not survive. The prospect of death hung like a cloud over the hearts of his disciples and permeated the monastic community with an intense awareness of its imminence. In Ajahn Panya's presence, death assumed a special significance, not as an impetus for melancholy thoughts, but as an urgent reminder that one's time on earth is fleeting. This was the final lesson that he bestowed on all of his students. Ajahn Panya's death was not an easy one. His room, filled with the odour of incipient decay, was overwhelmingly silent, but for the sound of his laboured breathing. Yet despite the uncertainty surrounding his potentially prolonged infirmity, he exuded a peaceful inner confidence, a spirited manifestation of his faith in the training and his fearlessness of death. That inner refuge enabled him to face death in a way that was at once thoughtful and serene. During the final week of his life, Ajahn Panya's overriding challenge was the constant fatigue of a body that had spent its karmic energy. He succumbed to utter exhaustion. His attendants were advised that unless he was induced to eat something, his digestive system would shut down, leaving him quickly at death's doorstep. Hospital doctors suggested placing a feeding tube through the nose and into his stomach. He flatly refused. Lay supporters hastily arranged for the preparation of flasks of soup and nutritious broths, which they offered in abundance each morning. But Ajahn Panya found it burdensome to force down even a few spoonfuls. Unable to eat, he gradually grew so weak that he could hardly manage even the simplest movements on his own. He continued to talk and laugh with those around him, but in a voice so faint they strained to make out what he said. Trying to force down a brew of his favourite tea, he joked with his attendants that nothing spoiled a good cup of tea like colonic cancer. When asked how he felt, he murmured softly that he felt no pain, only debilitating weakness. Several times the doctors offered to administer morphine, but his calm and quiet response was gently dismissive. Ajahn Panya remained alert and responsive to his environment until the night of August 16, when he seemed to let go of the external world completely. His breathing the following morning was deep and measured, but he evinced no knowledge of the world around him. Throughout the day and the final night, his breath became progressively shorter and shallower. By the early morning of August 18, his breathing was soft and smooth, but very frail. Soon it was barely discernible. Eventually it became so faint that no one knew precisely when it stopped altogether. The monks attending to Ajahn Panya in his final hour estimated the time to be 8:30 a.m. Ajahn Panya's passing was more than simply the death of a good monk. His death was a display of the depth of his realization and the power of the teaching that he had come to embody. In death, Ajahn Panya made his disciples aware that teachers of his caliber often concealed many exceptional qualities during their lifetime. Sometimes they showed them fully only at the moment of their death. Ajahn Panya's earnest conviction in the simplicity of a bhikkhu's life was evident from the mere handful of belongings that he left behind. Although born at a gold mine, gold was no different to him than dust. He never fell victim to fortune, fame, or worldly ambition. He did not have the reputation of a world-renowned teacher, a famous author, or an erudite scholar, nor did he exhibit mystical powers, claim psychic encounters with devas, or remain in seclusion for lengthy periods. He simply demonstrated that the truth of the Lord Buddha's teaching was to be found at the very heart of one's being. With grace and humility, he shared his wisdom and his confidence in the power of Dhamma to help liberate the minds of his fellow human beings. On August 28, 10 days after his death, Ajahn Panya's bodily remains were cremated at Bantat Forest Monastery. A special funeral pyre covered by an ornate Thai-style canopy was constructed on a broad stretch of ground at the front of the monastery, near a spacious pavilion that was built for use on large and important occasions. However, the pavilion was not nearly spacious enough to contain the thousands of monks and the tens of thousands of Buddhist faithful who gathered from all over the country as well as from abroad to offer their last respects to the monk whose impeccable goodness It warmed the hearts of so many people. The ceremony took place on a bright, cloudless afternoon, a blessed and welcome change from the stifling heat of the oncoming monsoons. For a moment, as Ajahn Panya's casket was placed atop the funeral pyre, the whole crowd was still. Then an extraordinary occurrence attracted everyone's attention skyward. Against the clear blue sky shone a fiery white light from a blinding, seemingly boundless source, a diamond-bright heart radiating outwards and fading to a softly diffused circular glow. Around this white diamond was a second circle, a ring of rainbow light with an outer border of luminous white down. It was the sun, resplendent in breathtaking purity, encircled by a magnificent rainbow which suffused the translucent, wispy clouds with a prismatic glow. The sudden apparition drew the gaze of the whole congregation and transfixed it on the heavens. A soft, amazed murmur passed through the crowd as the circular rainbow slowly dissipated and faded from view. Twice more during the course of the funeral ceremony, the natural elements conspired to conjure the same amazing phenomenon. It was as though the power of Ajahn Panya's spiritual attainment had induced this image to reflect the depth and subtlety of his virtue for all to witness. That vivid testimony to Ajahn Panya's profound spiritual awakening marked a supremely graceful conclusion to the life and practice of a monk whose kindness and humility radiated softly from his being to encompass the whole sentient universe.
Questions? Just totally by coincidence, we were planning to listen to one of Ajahn Ashulam's guided death meditations after the Pujas night. And I didn't set that up with that.
Lumpur, did you go to his cremation?
Oh. I was here. Was it 2004? I didn't know him that well. I met him two or three times. I didn't really know him very much. That was the impression was one of them. Say a good monk, quiet, humble. Not intent on drawing attention to the truth.